Hello again. Welcome to The Minefield. Watch your step. We're going to try to negotiate the ethical dilemmas of modern life, and what a big week it has been in ethics. Always wanted to say that, because that is normally the kind of sentence that is the preserve of football commentators, and sadly we're not going to be able to escape football today as we discuss the ethical dilemmas of the modern world. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. Where are we going, Scott?
Yeah, well, you know, if you are a football fan, or if, like me, you've never watched more than 30 minutes of sport in your entire life, it's actually been pretty tough to miss the controversy engulfing the administration of world soccer this week. A body which nonetheless overwhelmingly voted to re-elect its president, Sepp Blatter, for a fifth consecutive term. Here he is after the weekend election.
Ladies and gentlemen, I thank you. I thank you that you accepted me, that for the next 4 years I will be in command of this boat called FIFA, and we will bring it back. I like you. I like my job, and I like to be with you. I'm not perfect. Nobody is perfect. I promise you, in the end of my term, I will give this FIFA to my successor in a very, very strong position, a robust FIFA. I thank you for the trust and confidence. Trust and confidence. Together we go. Let's go, FIFA. Let's go, FIFA. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Well, I don't know what that meant either, Scott, I have to say. I don't know. I don't know what he was trying to say, except that I won and I'm here for 4 years. And then even that turned out to be wrong because, of course, as we've very recently learned, this happened.
Mon mandat à disposition.
This is why I will call an extraordinary Congress and put at its disposal my function. It is going to be held as soon as possible, and the new president will be elected to follow me.
So, 4 years became 4 days. Of course, he is still president in the interim until a new president is elected. And I can't help, Scott, I've been saying this ever since the story broke, but I can't help but see all the parallels with the Arab Spring here. Mm. Sepp Blatter is the Hosni Mubarak of world sport, it seems to me, because the whole thing is collapsing around him. He's saying, but no, I'm integral to it, and I'm the only person who can fix this, and then everything will be fine, and everyone loves me. And then it turns out prematurely he has to walk away. And that then leaves the question of what comes after. We've had our FIFA spring. What happens next?
Well, see, this is really interesting because one of the political analogies that many commentators were drawing was the analogy, in fact, not with the Arab Spring, but with Watergate. In other words, as soon as the whole Watergate affair broke, it was nonetheless 2 years until Richard Nixon himself was toppled. And in between those two times, Richard Nixon, of course, got reelected in a landslide. So I actually think your analogy with the Arab Spring is really interesting and actually probably far more apt. Let me push you one step further, though, Waleed. Mm-hmm. Take the example of Hosni Mubarak. He was toppled. He was one of these kind of Arab Dickensian villains, the man that suddenly the entire world had grown to hate. He was toppled. The head was chopped off the beast. This is the beginning of a brand new sort of democratic state of affairs. Hope was bounding eternal. But then very little seemingly ended up changing. Very little in terms of the actual culture of Egyptian politics itself changed, and hence al-Sisi was then returned, who was, you know, who is proven himself in many ways, both like Mubarak and in some respects even worse. Now, let me ask you, Waleed, I know nothing about this. I mean, I was being quite serious before. I've never watched more than 30 minutes of soccer in my life.
I can't believe you've repeated that admission.
Well,
you said it once, I let you get away with it. You said it again. I can't believe that you would do that.
Well, okay, let me try to make my case. I would like to say that it's a kind of, you know, high culture versus low culture thing, that I'd rather be, I don't know, at the opera or something. And I mean, well, okay, that's probably true. But the real reason with it, I suppose I have a bit of a purist understanding of what sport is. I mean, sport is a compact. It's a covenant between fans and the teams themselves. The teams are kind of the embodiment of the fans' hopes and aspirations and will, and it's almost a kind of externalized form of solidarity. It seems to me, though, that that's the last thing that sport is actually now about. You know, the injection of massive amounts of money, of corporate sponsorship, of drugs, of unrealistic expectations on the bodies of the players themselves. All of these things have driven sport, it seems to me, off the rails, and there's something quite artificial now, it seems to me, about what the fans are, in fact, spectating. And so I just find the whole thing, I've got to confess, just rather distasteful and really sort of banalizing more than anything else.
All right, well, there's a whole other show there to be had one day. But the question that you ask, I mean, actually what you've just said is related, I suppose, to the conundrum of FIFA, which is that this is something that becomes so popular that it attracts, like a magnet, just attracts so much money, so much sponsorship, so much interest. In its way, so much prestige. The World Cup is the event in the world, but even surpassing the Olympics, I would argue. Mm. And then it is run and administered by an organisation that is deeply corrupt. And the Egyptian analogy is good because, of course, the problem with Egyptian politics was that once Mubarak was gone, there was the deep state nonetheless. So even when they elected another president who, in his own way, on his own terms, was catastrophic, but nonetheless, he was never really comfortable in his juxtaposition, the tension that he had with the deep state.
Yeah.
Is that the same thing with FIFA? And I suppose we don't know that for sure, but the question that sits above that, I suppose, Scott, is this the fate of any organisation that administers something as popular as football, that has the kind of money that goes into it, but doesn't really have the mechanisms of accountability that you might expect in something like a nation state, even though there are clearly exceptions to that in the nation state's case?
Yeah, and look, it is worth reminding that it wasn't a specific allegation of corruption or bribery that actually brought this whole matter to a head. It wasn't, you know, it's not that suddenly the whole investigation surrounding the awarding of the 2018 World Cup to Russia, the 2022 World Cup to Qatar, it's not that, you know, this has suddenly sort of reared its head again. What's actually brought this to a head is the revelation that marketing and media executives in the Americas have paid unbelievable, I mean, astronomical amounts of money in order to secure lucrative rights. I mean, I think the question you raise is absolutely right. There are so many snouts in this particular trough. And look, I do get concerned, I suppose, Willie, that, you know, the media loves its villains. They love their figureheads. They love their people that everyone else loves to hate because it drives traffic, it garners interest. It also makes for a very simple narrative. I suppose my concern here is, okay, FIFA's critics have their man. Sepp Blatter's been toppled. And Sepp Blatter, was there ever a more Dickensian villainous name than that? I mean, seriously.
That's, you know, true, actually. I hadn't thought of that.
They have their man. What next? And, you know, it doesn't actually say a lot for the organization that one of the benefits, one of the virtues that Sepp Blatter's rival, Prince Ali bin al-Hussein, was said to have had, is because he's a prince, he doesn't need the money, and therefore it'll be harder to bribe him.
Yeah,
I mean, that doesn't exactly speak well for the ethical integrity of the organization.
No, that's not the entire story with Prince Ali bin Hussein.
No,
but yes, I do understand the point that you make there. So where does that leave us then? Because are we effectively saying that it is more or less an inhuman expectation that an organization such as FIFA could be run without corruption? That there are really no mechanisms that we can put in place to protect that because it doesn't have the accountability of a state, and that leaves us subject to human frailty. And ultimately, there are no moral codes that apply with sufficient enough force in this case to constrain whoever steps in as the next president. Are you effectively telling me that this is impossible to clean up?
No. Well, I certainly hope it's not impossible, because I am at heart an ethical optimist. But what I think should be said is that for a long time, we've lived with the realization, we've lived with the kind of resignation that what we need within corporations, what we need within corporate cultures is kind of codes of conduct. Okay, we can't stamp out corruption. We can't instill good virtues within employees, but at least we can get employees to sign up to certain relatively superficial codes that might constrain the worst behaviors. What I think all this demonstrates, especially when there is so much money at play, is that simple codes of conduct are not enough. There has to be a deep-seated, robust, you know, to quote Sepp Blatter, there needs to be a deep-seated,
robust
ethical culture within any organization that is susceptible to that much payment. There has to be a deep seat of moral sensibility. What is this company for? What is the deeper end that it's oriented towards? If it doesn't have that deeper sensibility, then I think this sort of thing is absolutely inevitable.
And it's made more complicated by the sheer scope of a sport like soccer, because it's all over the world. There are all kinds of people who have very different outlooks on life, different understandings of the way an organisation should be run. We see that expressed in the diversity of governments that exist around the world. So this is very complex. The only thing I would add before we get some more help, Scott, is that If we can assume this is the opportunity, the slate, if not clean, is perhaps cleanable, then the question arises, doesn't it, for sponsors, for fans, for people who are running confederations within FIFA, like UEFA in Europe or even Oceania or Asia or whatever it might be. This is yours to make. What will you make it? And what are the obligations on you in making it? What are the considerations that you should have? What mental map or moral map do you take into this? And I feel like it's this moment of great excitement, not because this Dickensian figure has been toppled, although he was more than merely a figurehead. He was deeply implicated in this, and I think the investigation will ultimately show that. But beyond that, if this organisation can be remade, in what image? In whose image? And I don't know how that will play out, but I do think that we should get some help in trying to explore that. You are on The Minefield. Waleed Ali's my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. You can leave a comment on our website. You can search for RN The Minefield, or you can just tweet at us at RN The Minefield, where Scott will no doubt zing you.
And yes, thank God for someone who's sportingly illiterate like me. Our guest today is Simon Longstaff, the Executive Director of the St. James Ethics Centre. Welcome, Simon.
Hi, Scott. Hello, Waleed.
Hi, Simon.
Let me quote to you something very interesting that Sepp Blatter said on the weekend. He said, "We can't constantly supervise everyone in football. You can't just ask people to behave ethically just like that." So, Simon, the critics of FIFA have got their man. What comes next? I mean, how do you restore something like ethical integrity and transparency to a corporate culture like FIFA?
Well, the first thing is you probably heard a small groan just escape from me as you were reading that quotation from Sepp Blatter, because it says everything, really. I mean, here's a man who's saying there really aren't any ethics, and he's starting from a null point and trying suddenly to introduce it. What a terrible admission, and what a good thing he's gone, and he shouldn't be hanging around for months. Now that he's made the decision, he should go straight away and allow them to get on with the job. But in terms of that conversation you were just having with Waleed, one thing that I think Waleed asked, which I just wanted to comment on myself, and that was, well, is it possible, in fact, to govern an organisation which has got great power and prestige and wealth without actually being corrupted by it? And we do know the answer to that, and that is that it is extremely difficult, but it is possible. And the case in point is that of Marcus Aurelius, the former Roman emperor, who was he was kind of like Sepp Blatter, even him on steroids. And yet he was able to preside over a government of the Roman Empire, which was deeply infused with ethical intent and integrity. So we know it can be done, but it's extremely difficult even for someone like that. But that's not the kind of model we want. We're not looking at having another emperor come in and look after soccer. So what I think we have to be able to do is really go back to some defining sense of purpose that grounds the whole activity. And you, Scott, almost got to it when you were talking about the compact between fans and sponsors and others with their sport, but I don't think you quite nailed it.
Okay.
And for me, the thing that I think is most important about sport, if you like its real promise, is that in a world in which so much is about glittering surfaces and spin, when a group of people, men and women, get into a contest on a field of play, people go because they see not just the contest itself, but something which is elemental and true, or at least that's what they need to believe of it. And if you suddenly find that it's been rigged or that the competition's being jigged by people who are taking performance-enhancing drugs, any of those things, that's what's being destroyed. It's that capacity for encountering something true. So when you get your sponsors, when you get everybody else thinking about it now, I don't want them to go back and say, oh, look, now we better get in this or out of it to do with our brand. I want them also to be thinking about what is the primary purpose of this activity and can they support that, and then build out from that purpose with the values and principles that support it.
The only thing I would say about that, though, Simon, is I think in FIFA's case, in some ways, that's the one sin they didn't commit. They didn't actually compromise the truth of the contest, and that's perhaps why they survived. It's perhaps why they were able to get away with so much corruption and everyone was powerless. The product retained its power, because when you put the World Cup on, you still believed in what was happening on the pitch. You just didn't believe in anything that was happening around it.
Well, some of the falls that you and I have probably seen on the pitch, even those you don't believe. But
no, that's true. But that's actually part of the strategy.
That's
of the
part
game
of the fun.
The
yeah, I know.
Player, yeah.
But look, I think that's also partly why it's been so terrible for people, in that they are holding on to the truth of what can be there on the pitch. But if everything around it is corrupt and debased, sooner or later that must fray. It starts to affect things in a way, infect things. And I just think that whether it was because of the pressure of US prosecutors or Swiss investigators or whatever, at least now they've got a chance to lance the particular boil that is FIFA and bring it back to a state of health.
There is another story to be told here. I mean, one of the things, paradoxically, that Sepp Blatter is now being praised for after the fact, as it were, is that he really did bring the world game to the rest of the world. He took it out of the European theater and delivered it to Africa, to South Asia. I mean, he invested a tremendous amount of money there. And, I mean, that really is one of the great legacies. Can I just...
But come on, Scott. Look, really, yes, let's all agree that there is a noble end which was served there, but the means which were employed were absolutely appalling. And there's nothing written in the structure of the universe that says that you have to go about securing good ends by dodgy means such as they employed. It was perfectly open to Sepp Blatter and to FIFA to pursue that objective, but by means which were consistent with the objectives they were trying to achieve, without all of the corruption. And why they felt they had to go the other way, I don't think it was anything to do with reason or compulsion. It was probably just purely greed.
A lot of that investment into Asia and Africa was siphoned off, and that's part of the issue.
Right.
But, Scott, I feel like you were digging at a question you didn't quite get out.
Well, now, I suppose, you know, even these bids to be able to host the World Cup and the attempts by marketing agencies to try to make sure that they had prime product placement. You know, both of you have talked about the integrity of the game, the authenticity of the game, in fact, being preserved. But, you know, the bids for the World Cup themselves were these great nationalistic chest-beating attempts to try to gain honor on the global stage. The way that that the product placement is worked to create, okay, you might want to call it an unfair advantage, but the fact that one sporting team has better footwear and better clothes than another, I mean, these are all aspects that are providing unfair advantages to some team or another. In other words, I can't see that the purity of the game can really be preserved when, like I said before, when there are that many snouts in this particular trough.
Well, look, let's just give you a counterexample, and not from football, but during the last Olympic Games, particularly with the Paralympics, many people may not know, is that there was an international group of engineers and others who were running workshops there where they were ensuring a universal access, if you like, to have equipment failures repaired so that everybody was on as even a playing field as possible. Mm. So, yeah, look, what you described, Scott, is an element of the way the game is currently structured, that is in football, and how people pursue these things. And you see it in the Olympics and other things. But it's not a necessary component of these things. It's a matter of choice. And it could be different if only different leaders impose different frameworks for people to make better decisions. And I think that's what's to be gained out of all of this.
Okay, Simon, let me come back to one of the issues you raised. That was the idea of purpose.
Yeah.
Is this really another form of consequentialism?
No.
Effectively what we should be doing is running our organisation by looking to what the consequences of our behaviour would be. So if we were going to be corrupt, we'd compromise the game.
No, that would be to misunderstand the whole tradition from which this comes. Now, Scott's going to get very excited in a moment because I'm going to mention the word Aristotle and Telos, and I shouldn't do it, Waleed, because you'll go running away and off we go.
But Aristotle is okay with it. It's when you say Aristotelian, he just loses his mind.
Oh, okay. Well, let's hold off that. We'll just keep ourselves in bounds.
Sure.
Now, the notion that Aristotle put forward about there being a telos or purpose or end to be served is not something which can be reduced to consequentialism where a particular outcome is to be brought. What you're trying to do is to make sure that the thing which is best for that kind of object, and classically the case is used, what is the telos of a knife? It is to cut. So it's in serving the defining purpose of an institution, which in many cases around the world has been forgotten right across the board, that you actually go about structuring the way things are organised. And that doesn't simply cash out to a series of consequences because the purpose comes before the consequence that might flow. So there is an important distinction to be made there, unfortunately often collapsed and confused in the way that the question implied.
Okay, let me up the philosophical ante here, though, because one of the things, yes, brace yourself, one of the things that Aristotle, of course, did do is he separated the immediate end that something is made to serve. So, for instance, I might use a knife to cut the apple because I want to eat the apple in order to satisfy hunger. But then there is the final end. There is the ultimate purpose that particular thing ultimately is made to serve. I may want to eat the apple because I want the energy in order to participate fully within the civic sphere, in order to benefit those around me, in order to enrich society as a whole. So let me put it to the two of you. What is the end of sport? If it's simply entertainment, then
well,
I think...
Not, But it's not that, is it? Because we've already established that it's about something to do with a proper correspondence around what purports to be and what actually is. Look, you know the answer to this question already, Scott, that ultimately sport as a human activity is going to be a contribution towards what's called eudaimonia, properly translated in English as flourishing. And that is the proper end of human beings, not to be happy, as some people mistranslate the term, but to flourish. Mm. And I'm going to leave it to Waleed to talk eloquently about what he finds in soccer, for example, or football, that is about human flourishing. And I'm sure he's got lots of things to talk about there.
We only have 6 minutes left, Simon. What do you want me to do with this?
Okay. Well, maybe an edited highlight, Waleed?
Well, no, I think there are so many functions that sport generally serves. And some of them are to do with the way in which that we can tell our own stories. Often they're morality plays, often they're demonstrations of particular virtues, different kinds of honour, courage. These are all the elements that actually make a sport compelling. And I find it's for the same reason that I love things like comic books, in that they can can become in some ways the purest distillation of some kind of concept or idea or human virtue that we're trying to explore or express.
Okay, hang on.
Let me ground things.
Well, maybe. No, actually, I'm not convinced.
I've got five more minutes to go if you want.
Let me ground this, because one thing I do know about people who follow sports is that they have no time at all for Johnny-come-lately fans. In other words, as soon as your team is doing well, lots of people who couldn't give a rat's about the history and the highs and the lows of the club suddenly jump on because they want to.
Because it violates the virtue of loyalty.
Yes, precisely. But hang on, I think there's actually something else going on here with sport, which is that this is one of the few public demonstrations that we have left in this world where rivalry actually unites people across lines. In other words, even though you want to come and you want to be in the same stadium with other people who are barracking ferociously for the other team, there is nonetheless something about the participation in the integrity of the context that brings you all together despite the rivalry. Now, that, it seems to me, is ultimately a great ethical lesson for politics as a whole, is it not?
Well, it's been around for ages. I mean, go back, we're talking here about the Western world and its ancient Greek heritage, but you could find it in other places too, where people, not just in sport, but the cathartic experience that people would have when whole communities would go to the theatre and see the plays of Sophocles and Aeschylus and people like that. That notion of coming together and sharing in the cathartic moment, the sorts of things that Waleed was talking about, it's often used for good. It can also be used for terrible harm too, where people get carried away and become a bloody-minded mass. Mm. But bearing that in mind, when it's at its best, it's a fantastic experience for human beings to share in that kind of solidarity of the moment.
Yeah, and there is a solidarity between sports fans, but that's usually because it's in contradistinction to the way they feel with non-sports heathens like Scott. Anyway, I'll move on, Simon. We only have about a minute for this, unfortunately, but sponsors, credit card companies, soft food, the fast food manufacturers, all
no need to list them all. That'll be the minute gone.
It will be. But what are they to do here? Because if they are to say, unless this is ethically cleaned up, we're not going to be involved with the World Cup, they do violate an obligation they have to produce profit for their shareholders, do they not?
Look, Waleed, it depends on which country you're talking about, but if you're talking about a situation in Australia, the duty of, say, a company director is to act in the interests of the company as a whole. And to the extent that there's any notional duty to shareholders, that's to shareholders in perpetuity, not to any particular group at the moment. So if you have a brand, and most companies now, the value is in intangibles like brands, and it says that it stands for something, if you start to align it with things which are corrupt or at odds with the underlying values and principles that inform that brand, you're ultimately going to be failing not only your duty to the company as a legal person, but if you want to take a long enough view, also to the shareholders. So you've got to find some underlying reason rather than just short-term profitability that grounds what you do.
Because if they lose market share in the meantime and ultimately end up in a position they can't recover from.
That's the whole point. That's the way that we've structured our company law, where we distinguish between the shareholders who own issued capital or some part of it. We give them the protection of limited liability because they're not directly involved in these decisions, in order to allow company directors to take the longer-term view.
Simon, it's been enlightening as always. Thank you so much for joining us in the minefield, and congratulations on surviving.
Thank you very much, and thanks to Scott too.
That's Dr. Simon Longstaff, Executive Director from the St. James Ethics Centre. Scott, I don't know if I can quite forgive you for the sport thing.
Well, yes, maybe other people won't either. If you do have a comment you'd like to leave for me, go to our website or you can tweet us at RNTheMinefield.
Sports analysis really welcome this week. Scott will pour through it. Until next week, this has been The Minefield. We'll see you then.